I'm in the car next to you on the highway. I sit in front of you on the bus. I'm one out of every six Americans, and I'm struggling with hunger. This isn't an uncontrollable epidemic. There's enough food in this country to feed every hungry person. Please, visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank. Every dollar you donate helps provide 7 meals for those around you, quietly struggling with hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Henry Ford Community College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. HFCC was one of only six community college programs studied by Recruiting New Teacher, Inc. and has been the model for other colleges around the nation. For more information about HFCC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
Give my regards to Broadway, remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the gang on 42nd Street that I will soon be there.
I'm Joe, host of The Best of Broadway. Every Tuesday from 2 to 4 p.m., we bring you the score of a Broadway musical as well as individual theatrical numbers. For the best in musical theater and theatrical music, join me and the gang on 42nd Street for The Best of Broadway, Tuesdays from 2 to 4 p.m. here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Hey, this is Derek, and you're listening to Skepticality, the official audio program of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, May
7th, 2013.
Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with researchers and skeptics from all walks of life for the promotion of critical thought and science. So, for those of you who made it to the Atlanta Skeptic Camp this past weekend, I hope you had as much fun as I did. If you didn't make it out to the one here in Atlanta, please take the time to find out if there's a skeptic camp in your area. If there isn't one, consider getting together with some of your friends and setting one up. It's a great way to share information, ideas, and thoughts, and get excited about the real world. And since we had a busy weekend here, this episode might be a tad shorter than normal. In fact, we were so busy that even our own Tim Farley had to play catch-up on sleep and a bunch of work. So you won't hear him until next episode. However, it seems that Bob Carroll and some of the other regulars were able to get enough sleep to send in their content.
This is Bob Carroll. Welcome to another episode of Unnatural Virtue. Today's topic is impenetrable belief armor. When arguing with a fervent believer in something paranormal, supernatural, or anti-scientific, I sometimes wonder what I could have written or said that would have been more persuasive. Other times I realize there is no weapon in my arsenal that could pierce the belief armor worn by my antagonist. For example, an astrologer once sent me a link to her website to remind me of how powerful her craft is. She believed that a lunar eclipse predicted the deadly fires that devastated large parts of Australia several years ago. When I asked her how she knew that it wasn't the fires that caused the eclipse, she replied, "Multi-branched are the minds of the indecisive." She then proceeded to inform me of several other earthly disasters that she was sure were caused by planets and other objects billions of miles away from Earth. It doesn't matter that there's no plausible mechanism by which planetary alignments could affect our weather, volcanism, earthquake activity, or the personality of an astrologer. What matters is that patterns can be found, which is true. Are those patterns meaningful? Sure, as long as you ignore most of the data. The belief armor worn by those who believe they are psychic is also impenetrable. I've had several people tell me they're psychic, but when I've asked them to prove it by taking a little test, I've never heard from them again. I've challenged a few who are convinced they are precogs to provide me with specific predictions, which I would post. We'd let the chips fall where they may. No dice. As soon as I asked them to put their abilities to the test, they cut off communication. Believers in psychics are also impenetrable. I once received an email from someone who asked that I not post her letter because all she wanted to do was, quote, "dispel my doubts," end quote, about an alleged psychic I had written about. The writer claimed she'd witnessed some amazing psychic abilities that consisted of two strangers telling her all about herself and her family. Had she understood subjective validation, confirmation bias, and the many facets of cold reading, perhaps she would have had some tools to help her see an alternative explanation for the apparent accuracy of the apparent clairvoyant couple. For some reason, she was adamant that the material she provided me was for information purposes only. She also told me that one of the psychics had been tested by the people at Columbia University, who specialize in that area, and they judged him to be authentic. And I didn't know they tested psychics at Columbia. Another group of impenetrables are the supplement fanatics. Several large-scale studies have been published over the years that have failed to find that vitamin and mineral supplements have any health benefits for people who do not suffer from specific deficiencies. This data has no effect on most of the millions of people who take daily vitamin supplements in the hope that doing so will benefit them. It's estimated that 40% of women and 30% of men take a daily vitamin mineral supplement. In fact, some studies have found that taking supplements can be harmful to your health. Yet there's no risk of the supplement industry suffering much from lack of scientific support for taking daily supplements as part of a healthy lifestyle. In the case of the supplement impenetrables, it seems that the most common mantra is, "What harm can it do?" Wishful thinking is also involved. Well, maybe it will do me some good. There's probably no general health risk in believing you or someone else is psychic, but there certainly are situations where such beliefs could be harmful or even deadly. Anyone who relies on psychic intuition or visions when deciding whether to consult a physician is asking for trouble. One of the saddest cases I've written about involved an inventor of an energy healing practice that ended up killing her. She was diabetic, and proper medical attention would probably have allowed her to live a much longer life. What was most distressing about her case was that her partner in life and in the invention of the treatment known as consanguinity was a trained physician. After Deborah Harrison's death, her ex-partner, Dr. Mary A. Lynch, moved to another state and founded Consilience Energy Mirrors. Lynch died a few years ago from septic shock. She treated her own infected toe with her energy medicine until the toe had to be amputated. She refused antibiotics, and the infection killed her. That hasn't stopped her from still being a model healer for those still practicing this form of energy voodoo. I think that for some people, the best we can do is offer the not-so-comforting epitaph, "She died with her belief armor on." The conspiracy armor is perhaps the toughest to penetrate. Each refutation of the conspiracy warrior's evidence results in a refutation that is a model of selective thinking. The warrior then moves to another point and throws down a new challenge. When that point is refuted, the process repeats itself. By ignoring whatever suits them, the conspiracy warriors are able to construct impenetrable walls with innuendo and possibilities. Then there are the warriors who believe they are on a holy crusade to save the children. I mean, of course, the anti-vaccination soldiers. These folks wear double-plated belief armor that allows only favorable anecdotes to get through. Any scientific studies that demonstrate vaccines are beneficial is rejected. They know that when one thing follows another, most of the time there's no causal connection between the events. But when it comes to connecting vaccinations with neurological or other health problems in children, their instincts tell them there's a causal connection, no matter what the scientific studies show. Such warriors may have good intentions, but children are suffering or dying because of the doubts they've raised in the minds of many parents about the safety of vaccines. Is there any weapon in the skeptic's arsenal that might penetrate the kind of belief armor I'm describing here? Maybe, but I haven't found it yet. Well, that's it for this episode of Unnatural Virtue. To find out more about the topics mentioned here, see the show notes in my website, The Skeptic's Dictionary. In the meantime, please commit some unnatural acts in public. And don't forget, skepticism, though unnatural, is a virtue.
This is Bob Blaskowitz from SkepticalHumanities.com. At any one time, I'm working on a couple of skeptical projects, most of which involve some sort of writing component, so I'm always on the lookout for more material. Last month, in the class I'm teaching about researching and writing about extraordinary claims, a student decided that he was going to look into medical quackery, and we brainstormed about topics that he could look into at the library. As we sat in the computer lab, I started entering some terms into the databases, looking for a source that might give him a head start. When I entered phrenology into the search box, I was surprised not only by how much came back, but especially by how much of it came back from journals in the humanities, especially in literature and history. I honestly knew next to nothing about phrenology, so I saved about 20 full-text articles with phrenology in their titles on the off chance that I'd have some time to look at them in depth later. Sifting through these articles, I was struck by the impact that phrenology managed to have on American culture. It came out of the work of German doctor Franz Joseph Gall in the first two decades of the 19th century and was popularized in the United States in the 1830s by a well-known physician named Charles Cardwell. I was surprised to learn from Robert E. Riegel, writing in the 1930s, that the earliest phrenologists were respectable physicians who had derived their theories by employing the empirical tools of observation and measurement to the psyche, even if the conclusions were uniformly unrevealing. The thought behind phrenology seems to have followed as such: that the brain consisted of modular faculties that were generally independent and localized, an observation that would have been supported through cases of traumatic injuries like the one received by Phineas Gage, whose personality changed radically when his left frontal lobe was largely destroyed by a railroad spike in 1848. It seemed not implausible that if mind and brain were deeply intertwined, that the size of these various organs in the skull might determine one's personality. And if the shape of the brain determined the shape of the skull, well, could not one possibly infer the personality traits of an individual from an examination of the contours of the head? Sure, there are a lot of speculative leaps in there, but it's not implausible. It could have been right, it just happened to not be, and quite quickly the interpretive flaws that doom phrenology were recognized. Phrenology, while in some ways reflecting a materialist sensibility about the origin of human character, was also a very convenient tool by which to confirm racial and social stereotypes, and belief that one's true inner nature would be written on one's body, like Dorian Gray's portrait. As such, it was an especially useful pseudoscience for reconfirming the inferiority of darker races and confirming the inherently criminal nature of the lower classes. What I'm most surprised by as I go through these articles is the number and variety of prominent historical characters who underwent phrenological analysis. These include Herman Melville, Edgar Allan Poe, Clara Barton, most of the northern generals in the Civil War, and the exhumed skull of Jonathan Swift. When these personages were not available for direct examination, phrenologists would base their analyses on paintings and busts of the figures. One of the most intriguing was a phrenological study of Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. The Nauvoo Wasp, on the 2nd of July in 1842, printed a letter from Smith's phrenologist, Dr. A. Crane, which he prefaces with, "Sir, I take the liberty to inform you that a large number of persons in different places have manifested a desire to know the phrenological development of Joseph Smith's head. I've examined the prophet's head, and he is perfectly willing to have the chart published. You will please publish in your paper such portions of it as I have marked, showing the development of his much-talked-of brain, and let the public judge for themselves whether phrenology proves the reports against him true or false. I'll reproduce Smith's phrenological reading at skepticalhumanities.com, but a few notes about it. The scores range from 1 to 12, 12 meaning that that part of the brain in question was very large. It turns out, according to Dr. Crane, Smith was extremely susceptible to and desirous of the opposite sex. A lot. Like 11 out of 12 a lot. Also, he was judged to have an enlarged region of critical acumen. He scored low on attachment to places of long residence, musical aptitude, destructiveness, indifference to life, and, interestingly, the sentiment of veneration, which is described as, quote, religion without great awe or enthusiasm, and reasonable deference to superiority. Mark Twain also had his head examined. In a series of articles published in the 1970s, literary scholars debated to what degree Twain was a believer in phrenology. Certainly he was familiar with phrenology and other forms of bunkum, its low-hanging fruit, and he often deployed his satirical skills against popularly discredited practices. The exchange that these scholars were having, however, seems to miss the point that whenever Twain was writing for a large popular audience, he was uniformly damning of phrenology, which suggests to me that was likely his attitude towards the topic. In Huck Finn, the King and the Duke, two traveling confidence men, included phrenology among their skills. Wandering phrenologists would come to Twain's hometown of Hannibal, Missouri, and give readings for a quarter. In his autobiography, he recounted, and I quote at some length, "The phrenologist took great delight in mouthing the great names of cranial features. They gurgled from his lips in an easy and unembarrassed stream, and the exhibition of cultivated facility compelled the envy and admiration of everybody. By and by, the people became familiar with these strange names and addicted to the use of them, and they batted them back and forth in conversation with deep satisfaction, a satisfaction which could hardly have been more contenting if they had known for certain what the words meant. It is not at all likely, I think, that the traveling expert ever got any villager's character quite right, but it is a safe guess that he was always wise enough to furnish his clients character charts that would compare favorably with George Washington's. It was a long time ago, and yet I think I still remember that no phrenologist ever came across a skull in our town that fell much short of the Washington standard." Twain also recounts a visit to a London phrenologist, once under a fake identity, and then again several months later under his own nom de plume. He found that the two readings in no way matched, and that the second one was clearly far more specifically tailored to his public persona. I would be remiss if I did not add one final literary figure who received a phrenological analysis. Walt Whitman employed the language of phrenology in his Leaves of Grass. For instance, when he praises the noble character of mechanics and farmers, especially the young men, he lauds, quote, "the freshness and candor of their physiognomy, the copiousness and decision of their phrenology, the picturesque looseness of their carriage, their fierceness when wronged, the fluency of their speech, their delight in music, their curiosity, good temper, and open-handedness, the whole composite make the prevailing ardor and enterprise, the large amativeness." And later in the poem, he questions himself, quote, "Who are you indeed who would talk or sing to America? Have you studied out the land, its idioms and men? Have you learned the physiology, phrenology, politics, geography, pride, freedom, friendship of the land, its substratums and objects?" Whitman didn't just use the language of phrenology, terms like amativeness, a phrenological feature suggesting sexual desire, and he didn't just use it as a metaphor for understanding the deeper truths of American character. He also praised phrenologists alongside geologists, chemists, mathematicians, and oddly spiritualists as lawgivers of poets. Furthermore, early printings of Leaves of Grass were initially distributed by Fowler and Wells, the New York publishers of the long-lived Phrenology Journal. Their office actually received Whitman's professional correspondence. Further, Whitman published his phrenological readings by Lorenzo Fowler in several editions of Leaves of Grass. So, for all its misuses and silliness, phrenology seems to have nonetheless left its mark on American culture. And indeed, at least a basic understanding of the pseudoscience is essential to understanding one of America's most important literary works. This is Bob Blaskowitz from SkepticalHumanities.com.
Greetings, Skepticality listeners. Do you know what to do in August? Come to Stockholm, Sweden, and meet astronaut Christer Fuglesang, activist Haley Stevens, stats guru Hans Rosling, undercover health journalist Anna Bessian, and many more at the 15th European Skeptics Congress. Friday the 23rd to Sunday the 25th of August in Stockholm, Sweden.
The 15th European Skeptics Congress. www.euroskepticscon.org.
www.euroskepticscon.org.
This is Susan Gerbig speaking to you today about the Grill of Skepticism on Wikipedia Project. Are you an avid podcast listener? Many of our podcasts specialize in interviewing our spokespeople. Guess what? We can take a quote from those interviews and add them to the interviewee's Wikipedia page. This spreads link love back to the original podcast as well as improving the interviewee's Wikipedia page. The edit is a simple one. The majority of your time you will be listening or reading transcripts of the interview and making sure you have the quotes exactly right. We have a couple projects started using Google spreadsheets just to keep it organized. The listener will check off each episode as it's added to Wikipedia. Quite a daunting task, but very supportive of our spokespeople and our podcasts. We need an army of people willing to take on these tasks. But I have seen the numbers of downloads for these podcasts. The army is out there. They just don't know they're needed and need to be trained. Please contact me if this interests you. The editing is not complicated, and we can teach you all you need to do in probably an hour. That conversation can happen however it is comfortable for you. Skype, Google+, email, phone, you just let me know. Your mission will be to listen to your favorite podcast, glean information from the interview, and write a sentence or two for the appropriate Wikipedia page and add a citation. Then make a note on the spreadsheet so others will not try to have to duplicate your work. Then you move on to the next one. You can spend as much or as little time working on this project. Simple, but super important. One more thing. Don't forget to spread a little skeptic love today. Review your favorite podcasts on iTunes. That review does more than just give feedback to the podcast. It helps others outside of our community find us. And don't forget to review a skeptic book wherever you read it, reviews. If you have a little spare change, please set up a revolving payment schedule with these groups so that they can justify the hours they spend working on creating this content you look so forward to listening to. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to The Odds Must Be Crazy on Skepticality, where it smells like Teen Spirit, which is only odd because you just heard that song on the radio before you got here, and there are no teenagers around. And to the best of your recollection, you never knew what Teen Spirit smelled like in the first place.
I'm Wendy Hughes.
And I'm Jared Kaufman.
And we're here to tell you stories that reveal a lot about timing and geography, and in this case, genealogy.
This story about researching a family tree comes to us from Bobby Goldstein. You can find it on our site starting today by searching for Irish Roots, or by clicking on the link in the show notes.
Bobby's story involves names of his ancestors, but we will use some pseudonyms and change the dates to protect the innocent.
Protect them from what?
I'm not sure. I'd like to think The Odds Must Be Crazy hasn't actually caused any harm to anyone so far. But Bobby's story starts out like this. I recently learned that because I have a couple of grandparents who were born in Ireland, I can get dual citizenship. This is pretty exciting to me, and so I'm doing the research and retrieving documents for folks who were born more than 100 years ago. I knew my grandpa pretty well, and I knew his birth date and what county he was born in. The helpful woman at the consulate suggested that I start by contacting the parish churches. So I started emailing parish churches in County Roscommon, and I got a hit. One church did have a John O. Smith born in October 11, 1901. We emailed back and forth, and they sent me a link to the government website where I could and did order a birth certificate. After I ordered it, I went back and looked at the emails from the church. They had a different birth date for him, and I just hadn't noticed. He was born January 11th, not October 11th. Everything else checked out, including both parents' first names. I checked with some relatives, and they all thought it was plausible that either Grandpa had gotten his birth date wrong somewhere along the line, or that someone had mistranscribed the birth month. But then I heard from a different parish church in the same town, and they had a John O. Smith born in 1901 on October 11th. Also, in the second one, while the parents, for example, my great-grandparents' first names were the same, they had a different birth name from my grandmother. So I called the records office, and there were two people born with the name John O. Smith in 1901, and I've got the birth certificate for the wrong one. Now, John O. Smith is not that rare of a name. And while Athlone is not a huge city, population about 20,000 now, I have no idea what it was in 1901, it's not tiny. So that part of it seems like not that big of a coincidence. But both were born on the 11th of the month. They were only two John O. Smiths born that year in the county. I think they said the county. It might have been the town. Both of them had a father named Patrick. Both of them had a mother named Bridget. I know that in cases like comparing Lincoln and Kennedy, you see so many coincidences because there are so many potential coincidences, and you can cherry pick. But here I can't cherry pick. I only know so much about my grandfather's birth, and yet just about everything except the birth month and the mother's maiden name matches up. How about that?
The Lincoln-Kennedy coincidences are pretty amazing when you first hear about them. They're great examples of selective perception. You can pretty much match up any two people in a similar way when you take the time to dig up every detail you can imagine about them. But back to this story. I assume you asked for some help on this one, Wendy?
Well, St. Patrick's Day has passed, but this story about Irish ancestors struck a chord in Barbara Drescher, a resident cognitive psychologist and statistician who has commented on the story.
As the submitter suggested, Barbara's comments include the phenomenon of cherry-picking. She said, "This isn't really as much like Lincoln Kennedy as it is like most of the other name stories that we get. There is certainly some hindsight bias involved. In the Lincoln Kennedy comparison, we notice the things that match, not the myriad of things which do not. But we should still be impressed with the number of things which are the same. Except that we shouldn't."
My head's swimming already. Go on, Jarrett.
She continues, "I don't have a good source of name frequencies in Ireland to quantify this. But being of Irish descent myself and having paid some attention to my own family tree, I can say that these names are indeed extremely common. What's more, individuals born in the same year are much more likely to share a first name than those born apart because name popularity follows a trend. Some, like John, Bridget, and Patrick, are extremely common and timeless names, most likely honoring a family member. Since the individuals share a last name, it is highly likely that they were related somehow, increasing the probability that the name would be shared."
I think in the 60s, a lot of boy babies were named Jason. People named their babies for popular concepts of the time. I knew quite a few babies named after plants. Heather, rose, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. One named Karma. Some subsequent generations have had a lot of Tiffany's, but not a lot of Wendy's. Actually, my name Wendy didn't exist before the story of Peter Pan.
I've heard that tidbit before. It's amazing to realize how quickly a character in a book can invade pop culture. I'm just hopeful we don't get too many children named Renesmee this generation. And shame on you for getting that joke. And me for making it.
Thanks for listening to The Odds Must Be Crazy. Make sure to stop by the site and share your thoughts in the comment threads about your own odd name coincidences or anything else you like, unless it's ads. We get enough of those already.
Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, circle us on Google+, and validate us in life. Hit the Submit a Story link on our site to share your own crazy stories or tweet the short ones with the hashtag TOMBC.
The Odds Must Be Crazy is a project in collaboration with the Independent Investigations Group in Los Angeles, California. Visit them at iigwest.org.
Barbara Drescher is a contributing editor to our blog and can also be found at icbseverywhere.com.
Our theme music comes to us courtesy of Mr. Deity himself, Brian Keith Dalton. You can find him at MrDeity.com.
Growing up as an actor, I used my middle name, Lennon, as my last name professionally.
That's a good Irish name.
Yeah. My agent said the last name Kaufman was too Jewish.
Too Jewish for Hollywood? I don't know how that's possible.
Thanks again, everybody. So, a little while back, a bunch of my friends out there in internet land kept sending me links to cool short videos on YouTube. They explain little scientific concepts about normal everyday things. I kind of noticed that they all came from the same people. They call themselves ASAP Science. So, with a little bit of snooping around, I found out this group was actually just a couple of friends, Mitchell Moffitt and Gregory Brown, who wanted to make a difference. So, I was able to contact Mitchell and set up some time to discuss where their idea came from and what motivates them to go off and create such great free content. So here I am today with Mitchell Moffitt.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good. So tell people a little bit about what the ASAP Science is.
Yeah, sure. So primarily it's a YouTube show or channel on the internet that just sort of started out of My partner Greg and I went to university together at the University of Guelph in Canada. And we just fell in love with science, and you know, we were always trying to get our friends and family involved and tell them the coolest aspects of science to kind of inspire them and kind of, you know, find that love inside themselves for science as well. And YouTube it was just kind of coming about while we were in university. So it wasn't really a platform to sort of share educational content, but, you know, over the past 5 to 7 years, just saw a lot of people, especially like a younger generation, identifying with YouTube as a medium, not only for entertainment, but actually for learning. And, you know, people go to YouTube to like learn how to tie a tie or to learn how to speak a language. And so we just kind of saw an opportunity with Greg being a teacher and seeing how, you know, how receptive the students were to YouTube whenever he would use it in class or anything like that. We saw an opportunity to kind of, you know, spread the stuff we love and share it and kind of make fun of science. Not make fun, but make it fun and find a way to, you know, make it relatable to people's lives. Because I think sometimes the problem is just that people think it's too hard, or maybe they weren't as interested when they were younger. But if you can kind of find a way to identify with them and find the science in their own lives, I think that kind of captures their imagination. So, yeah, we just kind of threw together some ideas and some videos and just put them up on the internet, and gradually people came, you know. If you build it, they will come, as they say.
Now, you guys started this when you were in class together?
No, well, like, we went to school together, and it was last year that we actually started it. So Greg's actually a teacher now, so we've been out of school for a couple of years, but we started it last year. But I just meant, like, during school, it was kind of like amongst our peers and people who weren't in science that we kind of did the same thing for. And then as YouTube kind of grew as its own medium for sharing this kind of content, we thought it was a cool place to reach an audience that we never could in real life.
Greg now lives in London?
Yeah, so he's actually teaching just outside of London, high school students. He's teaching science over there, which is kind of another testament to how cool the internet is, and that we've managed to sort of still do this project together across, you know, halfway across the world from each other. But yes, he's over there teaching right now.
Well, I was wanting to say, one of the reasons why it works so well is that it's not people in the videos. It's more education, but really fun.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that was kind of a question for us going into it was, you know, do we make videos of us talking about science, or what's kind of the most effective and captivating way to get people to watch? And I had just seen some videos in the same style that really worked for my, you know, attention span and really kind of caught my imagination in this sort of stop motion whiteboard animation style. And so I just felt like that was a good way to kind of remove the personality in a way that it really becomes about that science and about the lesson and less about sort of any other distracting things with people involved in stuff and stuff. So you're right, yeah, because it's that, we can both participate in that capacity.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I don't think it would work if he had moved away. So
right, yeah, exactly.
So what I love is some of the topics you guys take on, which is kind of fun. Like, I love the power of naps, which mm-hmm. is always a good one for people who like to sleep a lot.
Yeah, everyone's really curious about sleep. We still get tons of questions about sleep and how to be less tired. And I think, yeah, the videos that do really well are just the ones that really sort of speak to people in their everyday lives and the things that they're actually curious about. And so for us, it's an opportunity to make them realize, hey, there's like science involved here, and it's actually fun stuff to learn. We're not just like boring you with all these crazy details, but you can realize that, you know, naps and sleeping, you know, we can learn about the things underneath them that you didn't know before, and you'll understand a bit more about your own life.
Well, Adam, you said that you started this shortly after you're in school together. This is why I asked, because one of them was the scientific cure for a hangover.
Yeah, I think everyone's looking for that too, you know. You see, everyone's trying to make the like pill that cure your hangover or something like that. And so it definitely just wanted to tackle that idea and sort of see what evidence is out there for what in terms of prevention and in terms of cure, other than not drinking, which is obviously the ultimate hangover cure, or preventative measure. Yeah, see, that kind of like speaks to the sort of notion of we're trying to sort of bring in people who maybe don't find science captivating. And so speaking to those things that, you know, having a hangover, you know, most people can identify with and relate to. So if you can kind of give them that that gateway topic into science. Because then when you actually watch the videos, you're like, hey, this is actually like scientific, and I'm learning scientific nomenclature and the different drugs and names and things like that. So on the surface, it's like, hey, here's something we all experience. And then below, it's like, hey, here's actually what is happening.
Very cool. Now, is the most popular video you actually have done ever the one on orgasms?
Surprisingly, it's not.
Really?
Yeah, actually, the most popular one is just an amazing facts video. We just thought it would be cool to kind of, you know, skew together a bunch of different facts in one video that were kind of either mind-blowing or, you know, really fascinating, but didn't necessarily need a full video to explain. And I think just because it was, like, so quick-paced and it's just a whole bunch of information in one video, that video did really well. But the science of orgasms, I mean, it depends on the internet, right? Because when you first start out, you have zero subscribers, and it's harder to get in those views. And as your audience grows, your potential to reach more people grows with them because, you know, then they're all sharing it with their friends. So it's easier for us to get more views now than it was at the beginning when we first started, precisely because of the amount of people who will come back each week and share our stuff.
Yeah, I've noticed that in our stats for our show, the older episodes have some of the higher numbers because over time, people keep sharing them.
Right, yeah, and they go back and check them out. And so, I mean, it's kind of, the more and more videos we have, like, not everyone will go back and see the new videos, but they'll often subscribe and make sure they come back each week for the new ones as well. So I think in terms of something going viral, now that we have, say, like 400,000 subscribers, instantly all that group of people are, you know, hopefully sharing it and stuff like that. So it can kind of make its way into the sort of mainstream internet more quickly.
So I read an interview that you did where you said that most of the people who subscribe are actually mainly younger teenage audience.
Well, we kind of built it with that in mind because Greg's a teacher. And like I said, we just sort of saw YouTube as a space that lots of younger people, especially teenagers, were in. And I've got a couple younger siblings who literally spend their life watching YouTube videos after they get home from school. But the bulk of our demographic is actually men who are like 30 years old.
Wow.
which is interesting. And yeah. So it was kind of like not a shock for us, I guess. We are kind of in that quirk science space, and a lot of it, you know, is related to, I guess, things that would catch a man's attention, whether that's like the science of morning wood or, you know, whether that's like drugs and alcohol. Not to say that women aren't interested in these things, but I think a lot of the websites who, you know, kind of helped us to grow and shared our stuff were very sort of science and technology based. So I think we sort of adopted that audience, but we can sort of see a shift become, I guess, more mainstream is the word. The audience kind of starts to spread out more, and it's more of an even mix of sort of all these age demographics.
Yeah, because I was wondering about that, because when I read it, I wasn't sure if you mentioned it as if that was what you found out or if that's what you were aiming for.
Yeah, I think originally we had it in mind to sort of, you know, inspire a kid's interest in science so that they then would hopefully, you know, want to stay in science school. And if they didn't have that interest before, maybe it was kind of like that gateway for them. But it's been fascinating to see that, you know, people of all ages are actually interested in learning. And someone who maybe didn't click with science when they were younger doesn't mean they're not interested in it. Maybe they just, you know, it wasn't presented to them in a way that kind of fit their style. So that people of all ages can actually still kind of use ASAP Science and other educational sources and videos on the internet to kind of launch their science interest from a sort of general science standpoint without too much embedded knowledge from their education.
Well, the nice part about that is it means that nobody at any age group is left behind.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why the internet is so great, and YouTube in particular. And there's things like Khan Academy, you know, free learning resources on the internet where it's never too late to learn. And not that it was too late to learn in the past, but it just becomes increasingly easy to learn on the internet and to learn really in-depth things. So even though we're not describing, you know, the really intricate aspects of like biology or anything like that, there are those resources out there for free if people want to go and learn them, which is really, really interesting and I think changing the dynamic of education in the entire world.
So you mentioned that Greg is a teacher by profession. When you guys went to school, were you guys in school for science or is it just a love?
Yeah, no, we both went for biological science, and then I had a focus in genetics, and then Greg actually had one in studio art, and then he went to school for, went to teacher's college to become a teacher. But yeah, it's always kind of been embedded both in our education and in our interests. And I think one thing that we sort of bond over and kind of, you know, found is that it was in high school, actually, that we were first inspired in it, and it just so happened that we both got lucky and had these what we considered amazing teachers in the science subjects that kind of inspired that interest. And so for us to start this channel, going back to sort of hoping to inspire younger kids in high school or grade school, was the idea that the internet provides the opportunity for anyone to teach. And so then you get a slew of different, it can fit different types of people, right? So ASAP science may not be the best way for somebody else to learn, but some people are going to really identify with it, and then they can stick around and watch lots of these videos. And it just opens the playing floor for, you know, a school really only gives you one science teacher. And so they're either awesome and you love them, maybe they're mediocre, or maybe you hate them. But the internet kind of allows this monumental shift in the amount of people that can sort of teach you and identify with your learning style. And so we were hoping to kind of get in there somewhere and offer something like different.
Well, the best part I found with your videos, because I've done this before, is that the way you've set them up, and it, because it's not people and it's that whiteboard style of teaching, they're really easy to send to people that you work with or anything like that, because they're so just education bites rather than any, there's nothing in them that would make anybody get uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, like I said, I just found those whiteboard videos that I had seen in the past always were able to capture my attention, and not even just for short attention spans, but like I've seen videos that are 10, 20 minutes in that style, and they still manage because there's that sort of constant movement, and it really is removed from a person, which, you know, kind of sucks me in because I don't know, for whatever reason, just staring at one person talk about something for a long time can, you know, draw your attention away over time. But for some reason, the whiteboard version keeps my attention.
You have things moving around all the time.
Exactly. And it's like your brain's trying to guess what it's going to draw next and kind of figure out what the image is while it's listening to the text. And you're constantly being stimulated in a way that just, you know, staring at a professor's face in class may not do for you.
So let everybody know a little bit about where to find the channel and how to find anything about you, anything you're else involved with.
Sure. So the channel is on YouTube, and you can just go to youtube.com/ASAP Science, which is ASAP Science, as soon as possible is what it stands for. But we're also on Facebook and Twitter. So the same sort of thing, facebook.com/ASAP Science, twitter.com/ASAP Science. And so our YouTube channel is where most of our videos, or all of our videos, go up, just kind of explaining these kind of quirky science phenomenons. And then Twitter, we kind of have different science daily facts. And on Facebook, we have like different science news and funny pictures and inspiring images of science. So kind of different things in all those different places that people can go and check out what we're doing.
So that means everybody has to subscribe to everything to get the whole experience.
Exactly. Yeah, we tried to make it a reason. I mean, we're on Tumblr as well if you want to follow us there too. And we're trying to make it so, you know, it's not just the exact same thing in every different location, but you're going to get, you know, a different piece of science and a different perspective of science in all those different locations.
So cool. Well, thank you so much for taking some of your time.
Not a problem.
I thank Mitchell for taking the time away from creating the next great science video to talk to me. I also encourage everyone who has not seen some of the cool videos that Mitchell and Gregory create to go take a peek. It's possible you might be able to send some of them to your friends who might need some help understanding the natural world. Worst case, you might learn something cool yourself. As always, you can find links to all sorts of cool stuff you heard here in the show notes for this episode, which is on our website over at www.skepticality.com.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app for iOS, Android, Kindle, PC, or Macintosh. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite skeptical content.
God isn't interested in technology.
I'm a little nervous because my wife, Yvonne, said to me, she said, Jeff, you watch the TED Talks. I said, yes, honey, I love TED Talks. She said, you know they're like really smart, talented people. I said, I know. She said, they don't want like the angry black man. So I said, no, I'm going to be good, honey. I'm going to be good. I am. But I am angry. And the last time I looked, this is why I'm excited, but I'm angry. This year, there are going to be millions of our children that we're going to needlessly lose. That we could right now, we could save them all. You saw the quality of the educators who were here. Do not tell me they could not reach those kids and save them. I know they could. It is absolutely possible. Why haven't we fixed this? Those of us in education have held on to a business plan that we don't care how many millions of young people fail. We're going to continue to do the same thing that didn't work. And nobody is getting crazy about it, right? Enough to say enough is enough. So here's a business plan that simply does not make any sense. You know, I grew up in the inner city, and there were kids who were failing in schools 56 years ago when I first went to school. And those schools are still lousy today. 56 years later. And you know something about a lousy school? It's not like a bottle of wine. Right? Where you say like 87 was like a good year, right? That's not how this thing. I mean, every single year, it's still the same approach, right? One size fits all. If you get it, fine. And if you don't, tough luck. Just tough luck. Why haven't we allowed innovation to happen? Do not tell me we can't do better than this. Look, you go into a place that's failed kids for 50 years. And you say, so what's the plan? And they say, well, we're going to do what we did last year this year. What kind of business model is that? Banks used to open and operate between 10 and 3. They operate 10 to 3. They will close for lunch hour. Now, who can bank between 10 and 3? The unemployed. They don't need banks. They got no money in the banks. Who created that business model, right? And it went on for decades. You know why? Because they didn't care. It wasn't about the customers. It was about bankers. They created something that works for them. How could you go to the bank when you were at work? It didn't matter. Then they don't care whether or not Jeff is upset he can't go to the bank. Go find another bank. They all operate the same way, right? Now, one day, some crazy banker had an idea. Maybe we should keep the bank open when people come home from work. They might like that. What about a Saturday? What about introducing technology? Now, look, I'm a technology fan, but I have to admit to you all, I'm a little old. So it was a little slow, and I did not trust technology. And when they first came out with those new contraptions, these tellers that you put in a card and they give you money, I was like, there's no way that machine is going to count that money right. I am never using that, right? So technology has changed. Things have changed. yet not in education. Why? Why is it that when we had rotary phones, when we were having folks being crippled by polio, that we were teaching the same way then that we're doing right now? And if you come up with a plan to change things, people consider you radical. They will say the worst things about you. I said one day, well, look, if the science says, this is science, not me, that our poorest children lose ground in the summertime, right? You see where they are in June. You say, okay, they're there. You look at them in September, they've gone down. You say, woo. So I heard about that in 75 when I was at the Ed School at Harvard. I said, oh, wow, this is an important study because it suggests we should do something. Every 10 years, they reproduce the same study. Says exactly the same thing. Poor kids lose ground in the summertime. The system decides you can't run schools in the summer. You know, I always wonder, who makes up those rules? For years, I went to the Harvard Ed School. I thought I knew something. They said it was the agrarian calendar and the people had. But let me tell you why that doesn't make sense. I never got that because anyone who knows if you farm, you don't plant crops in July and August. You plant them in the spring. So who came up with this idea? Who owns it? Why did we ever do it? Well, it just turns out in the 1840s, we did have schools were open all year. They were open all year because we had a lot of folks who had to work all day. They didn't have any place for their kids to go. It was a perfect place to have schools. So this is not something that is ordained from the education gods. So why don't we? Why not? Because our business has refused to use science. Science! You have Bill Gates coming out and say, look, this works, right? We can do this. How many places in America are going to change? None. Okay, yeah, there are two. All right? Yes, there'll be some place. Because some folks will do the right thing. As a profession, we have to stop this. The science is clear. Here's what we know. We know that the problem begins immediately, right? This idea is 0 to 3. My wife, Yvonne, and I, we have 4 kids, 3 grown ones and a 15-year-old. It's a longer story. With our first kids, we did not know the science about brain development. We didn't know how critical those first 3 years were. We didn't know what was happening in those young brains. We didn't know the role that language, a stimulus and response, call and response, how important that was in developing those children. We know that now. What are we doing about it? Nothing. Wealthy people know, educated people know, and their kids have an advantage. Poor people don't know, and we're not doing anything to help them at all. But we know this is critical. Now, you take pre-kindergarten. We know it's important for kids. Poor kids need that experience. Nope. Lots of places doesn't exist. We know health services matter. People, you know, we provide health services, and people are always fussing at me about, you know, because I'm all into, you know, accountability and data and all of that good stuff. But we do health services. I have to raise a lot of money. People used to say, when they come fund us, Jeff, why do you provide these health services? I used to have to make stuff up, right? I'd say, well, you know, a child who has cavities is not going to be able to study as well. And I had to, because I had to raise the money, right? But now I'm older, and you know what I tell them? You know why I provide kids with those health benefits and the sports and the recreation and arts? Because I actually like kids, right? I actually like kids, right? But when they really get pushy, people really get pushy, I say, I do it because you do it for your kid. And you've never read a study from MIT that says, giving your kid dance instruction, right, is going to help them do algebra better. But you will give that kid dance instruction, and you will be thrilled that that kid wants to do dance instruction, and it'll make your day. And why shouldn't poor kids have the same opportunity? It's the floor for these children. So, So here's the other thing. I'm a tester guy. I believe you need data. You need information. Because when you work at something, you think it's working, and you find out it's not working. Right? I mean, educators, you work, you say you think you got it, you're great. No, and you find out they didn't get it. But here's the problem with testing. The testing that we do, we're going to have our test in New York next week, right? This is in April. You know when we're going to get the results back? Maybe July, maybe June. And the results have great data. They'll tell you Raheem really struggled, couldn't do two-digit multiplication. And it's so great data, but you're getting it back after school is over. And so what do? You go on vacation. You come back from vacation. Now you've got all of this test data from last year. You don't look at it. Why would you look at it? You're going to go and teach this year. So how much money did we just spend on all of that? Billions and billions of dollars for data that it's too late to use it. I need that data in September. I need that data in November. I need to know you're struggling, and I need to know whether or not what I did corrected that. I need to know that this week. I don't need to know that at the end of the year when it's too late. Because in my older years, I've become somewhat of a clairvoyant. I can predict school scores. You take me to any school. I'm really good at inner city schools that are struggling. And you tell me last year, 48% of those kids were on grade level. And I say, okay, what's the plan? What did we do from last year to this year? You say we're doing the same thing. I'm going to make a prediction. This year, somewhere between 44 and 52% of those kids will be on grade level, and I will be right every single time, right? So we're spending all of this money, but we're getting what? Teachers need real information right now about what's happening to their kids. The high stakes is today, because you can do something about it. So here's the other issue that I just think we've got to be are concerned about. We can't stifle innovation in our business. We have to innovate. And people in our business get mad about innovation. They get angry if you do something different. If you try something new, people always ask you, oh, charter schools. Yeah, it's charter. Let's try some stuff. Let's see. This stuff hasn't worked for 55 years. Let's try something different. And here's the rub. Some of it's not going to work. You know, people tell me, yeah, those charter schools, a lot of them don't work. A lot of them don't. They should be closed. I mean, I really believe they should be closed. But we can't confuse figuring out the science and things not working with we shouldn't therefore do anything. Right? Because that's not the way the world works. You think about technology. Imagine if that's how we thought about technology. Every time something didn't work, we just threw in a towel and said, let's forget it. Right? You know, they convinced me, I'm sure some of you would like me, the latest and greatest thing, the Palm Pilot. They told me, Jeff, if you get this Palm Pilot, you'll never need another thing. That thing lasted all of 3 weeks. It was over. I was so disgusted I spent my money on this thing. Did anybody stop inventing? Not a person. Not a soul. The folks went out there, they kept inventing. The fact that you have failure, that shouldn't stop you from pushing the science forward. Our job as educators, there's some stuff we know that we can do, and we've got to do better. The evaluation, we have.
Hello, everyone. This is Omni 646, and I'm here to let you know that as of April 8th, you can register for fall semester. Now, the fall semester here at Henry Ford Community College begins August 22nd. You can use RevAdvisor, or you can go to the registration office in the Welcome Center. We have cheap tuition, your classes are guaranteed to transfer, and you know what? I mean, it's just a great place to be all around. Now, first-time students can go to the Welcome Center, or you can go to www.hfcc.edu/apply. Again, it's www.hfcc.edu/apply. And you know what? If you've already applied and you've already registered, you can go to WebAdvisor. So you know what? There's really nothing stopping you, so be sure to apply right now. Register right now at Henry Ford Community College for the fall semester 2013.
Disclaimer. This show is a
WHFR.
89.3.
WHFR.
Dearborn.
WHFR.
.FM.
WHFR.
Yankee Waves.
89.3 WHFR. New FM dial.
All right, I've gone through all the tracks. Just move through the beats. Do your thing.
All right, everyone, let's hear it for West High's own Brooke Turner, a.k.a. DJ Hook.
Scratching up my first school dance takes confidence. So getting into college, I've got what it takes. So do you.
Listen to how to